Welcome, everybody. Sorry to be a little late. Welcome to, is it the first LSE Times election debate? As you will see, we know something the Prime Minister doesn't know about the election, which is it's going to take place. If it doesn't take place on May the 5th, we're going to have a lot of debates. But anyway, welcome again. The subject of the debate is the Constitution. Whether this is a comment by the Times or LSE on the Constitution, for some reason we have three peers debating it. We haven't got a vote between them. But the assumption is at least that the Constitution now rests with the House of Lords, for which there's some evidence in the last few weeks, and that's a good thing. So we hope to have a lively debate. I'm going to say very little, except that each of them is their party's spokesman in the House of Lords on this subject. The topics, which I haven't fully told them, the topics they're going to talk about is the future of the House of Lords, devolution, regionalism. I think those were the things that most people wanted to hear debated this afternoon. They're each going to speak for about 5, 6, 7, or 8 minutes. Then they'll have a riposte to each other briefly. Then I'll come out to you, and then they'll sum up at the end, and we'll close about 7:25, if that's all right. So straight away, I'm going to ask Lord Faulkner, who every time I come across Lord Faulkner, he's about to be sacked. Are you still Lord Chancellor?
I am.
You are. Congratulations. Over to you.
Thank you. The time before last that I was going to be sacked, I was going to be sacked partly because of Simon, because we were engaged together in the Dome, and there came a point when every single newspaper in the country was calling for my resignation. And it lasted for weeks and weeks and weeks, and eventually it ended, or I thought it ended, when there was a newspaper called The Star. Some of you may not know, there is a newspaper called The Star, but there is a newspaper called The Star, and it had an editorial that began, "Lord Faulkner should not resign." I thought, the worm has turned. Unfortunately, the editorial went on, "Lord Fatty should be placed on the top of the Dome and they should both be burnt to a cinder." So just when you thought it was safe to go back in the water. I'm delighted to be here, to be engaged in a debate about our Constitution. I've got no idea when the election is coming, but everybody assumes that we're in the run-up to an election. So let's treat it as we are in the run-up to an election. And let us very, very seriously debate the issues. The Constitution, I have a sneaking suspicion, will not play a very significant part in the election because people won't want to talk about it. That's wrong, I think. I think it is an absolutely vital issue. And it's an area, I believe, where this government has a proud record and a very distinct vision for the future. In the period before 1997, there'd been a period, I believe, of complete constitutional stagnation. The previous government, and probably governments before that, had not been willing to engage in constitutional debate and constitutional change, probably because they didn't see it as being at the forefront of the political debate. As a result of that stagnation, there were, I believe, real problems in the governance of the country. First of all, Parliament. The Lords in 1997 was made up substantially of hereditary peers. Hereditary peers are tremendously nice people, and you'll be about to meet one, Lord Strathclyde, who is a tremendously nice person, who is nice to pets. However, the consequence of there being a significant majority of hereditary peers was that the House of Lords was completely dominated by the Conservative Party. In 1999, the vast majority of the hereditary peers was removed. The consequence of the removal of the vast majority of the hereditaries is that the House of Lords, on most issues, is now in balance between the government party, which is in a minority, a significant minority, and the official opposition, led by Lord Strathclyde, and the Liberal Democrats, led by Lord McNally. He's a life pair, and therefore is horrible to pets, and the crossbenchers. What it means is if there is a coalition against the government, it can be defeated. In effect, therefore, what happens in the Lords is now significantly different. Before 1997, on average, the government was beaten about 12 times a year. Now it is beaten about 60 or 70 times a year. And I believe if the current arrangements continue, that would continue whoever the government was, because we've completely transformed the nature of the House. Now, because the House defeats the government from time to time, the government listens and it makes changes. That is a good thing, and my goodness, it is a different way to run a second chamber. There's a lot more to do in relation to the Lords, and I'll come to that in a moment, but don't be under any illusions how significantly the second chamber has changed. The years of stagnation prior to 1997 also led, I believe, the peoples of Scotland and Wales losing confidence in Westminster as an adequate and sufficiently connected body to deal with the needs and concerns of their peoples. The devolution arrangements gave both those countries a body which was closer to their peoples. And they've developed policies, the English and the Welsh Parliament, and the Scottish and the Welsh Parliament and Assembly, that are distinctly Scottish and distinctly Welsh. I bet you very many people have got very considerable complaints about the particular policies pursued by those two assemblies and parliaments. But every parliament gets complaints about what it decides. But make no mistake, the effect of those devolution measures was to break the charge towards separation. Now the nationalist parties, both in Wales and in Scotland, are no longer a force for separation. So the effect of devolution, I believe, has been to strengthen the union on which the country depends. The protection of individual rights in this country has been strengthened in a way which the state has never accepted in the past. By incorporating the Convention on Human Rights into the law, we are prepared to give the individual the means with which to resist the state when it goes too far. The incorporation of the Convention into our law is a profound recognition that there are some basic rights to which the people are entitled and which they can reasonably expect to defend in the courts. The events of the last 3 months on the fight against terrorism show the consequences of the constitutional changes that we've made. On the 16th of December 2004, the Law Lords declared Part 4 of the anti-terrorism and crime legislation incompatible with the Convention. On the 22nd of February 2005, because of the decision of the Law Lords, we introduced new legislation to correct that incompatibility. The legislation which we've introduced is compatible with the Convention. There is now, in constitutional terms, a framework of law within which the question of striking the balance between national security and civil rights can be judged, and judged not by the politicians, but by the courts. The precise place where the line is to be drawn is a matter of constant debate. Far better that there be some objective standards by which that can be drawn, rather than the assertion and counter-assertion of the politician. The issue between the Lords and the Commons at the end of last week was a reflection of the new constitutional arrangements. Legislation being debated because the courts had declared the previous law incompatible with the Convention, the government accepting that they could not continue with the previous law, the Lords asking the government to think again on a whole range of issues on the replacement law, the government listening in a huge number of respects, but the Commons ultimately saying enough is enough. And that's the right balance, and I can tell you, pre-1997, it would have been done in a completely different and a completely uninvolving way. Be under no illusions what the effect of the constitutional changes we've done have been. None of it would have happened if there'd not been the reform of the Lords in terms of the removal of the hereditaries and the incorporation of the Convention. Now, you can take the view that you're happy to accept these changes as long as they don't do things you dislike, because one of the consequences of giving the courts and the Lords that power is that you've got to accept it even when it's doing things that are unpopular. We accept that that is the position. To have not devolved, I believed, would have threatened the union. To have left the hereditaries would have left the House of Lords irrelevant and wholly in the hands of one party. To have left the Convention offshore would have left our citizens' basic rights unprotected. I believe that these changes go with the grain of the public's view. our constitutional changes have always recognised that there are some issues where the public's appetite is for decisions to be taken away from the political arena. Basic rights and freedoms are one. Another is the basic economic policy of the country. Independence of the Bank of England to set interest rates takes out of the hands of politicians the ability to use a major tool of economic management for political advantage. And again, that is a good thing. Whilst the public may not be interested in the detail of constitutional change, they do want a more responsive government and a more connected state. The changes we've already made are profound. To seek to unpick them now, I believe, would be hugely damaging. I doubt whether any political party is seriously contemplating doing so. We judged these changes right, I believe. But there is much, much more to do. The need for a separate Supreme Court, as opposed to a final Court of Appeal inextricably linked with the legislature, is urgent as the court's role in areas such as human rights becomes more significant. Both Houses of Parliament have accepted that, and there will shortly be a bill. We need a new role for the Lord Chancellor, no longer a judge or the head of the judiciary, but a minister with the Lord Chief Justice, an independent judge, as the leader of the judges. Again, widely accepted by both Houses of Parliament. The need for an independent Judicial Appointments Commission is obvious and accepted. The need to progress further the reform of the House of Lords and to empower local government more without increasing the number of politicians is also vital. We may, as I say, be approaching an election. If we are, then you will find a political party with a manifesto recognising the need to reform, always with the same basic objectives: to better connect the citizen with the state, to ensure our constitutional arrangements promote confidence in the government, and to convince people that the arrangements will ensure their views and aspirations are reflected in the way that we're governed. We've done the things which most political parties drop the moment they get into government. We've strengthened our constitutional arrangements. We've been right to do so because I believe the public is now better governed. On constitutional reform, our message is as our messages across government. There's more to come. We've done a lot, but there is a great deal more to do. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much, Lord Chancellor. And I would like to ask Lord Strathclyde, Tory leader in the House of Lords and spokesman on constitutional development, to speak to us. Thank you.
It is a very great privilege to come here and speak to you all at the LSE. Apart from anything else, how wonderful it is to address an audience that's considerably younger than the one that I'm used to in the House of Lords. I'm tempted to say that after 110 years, it is the LSE that's almost become a part of the Constitution itself. Of course, that might invite the Lord Chancellor and his colleagues to come around and abolish it. As if it were not enough to be old, of course, you will know that one of the first teachers at the LSE was the great constitutional expert, A.V. Dicey. Now, as we all know, in the eyes of New Labour, anything old is suspect. Last week, we discovered that even such a foundation of our liberties as the Habeas Corpus Act was to be overridden for all the efforts of the House of Lords. And if you want to know the difference between the Prime Minister's view and mine, it would be this. He believes that anything that is old is bad, whereas I suggest that many institutions, the LSE included, become old because they're good, because they have withstood the test of time. Now, as he said, Lord Faulkner and I get on well. That's one of the charms of British politics. Same is true for Lord McNally and I and the Lord Chancellor. But the Lord Chancellor is also in danger of becoming increasingly eccentric. He accepted the office of Lord Chancellor only in order to abolish it, and in the course of our debates, he once enunciated what ought to now be known as the Faulkner Doctrine. And that is, yes, it is working outstandingly well, but it might not work well in the future, so it's a good idea to change it now. I hope for Lady Faulkner's sake that New Labour never extend that philosophy to the institution of marriage. Now, the government's case The government's case falls back time and time again to the argument, change is good, and they, and that is people like me, are against it. It is, of course, a beguiling argument, tailored in a faintly patronizing way to a younger audience, as if New Labour took it for granted that those of us here under 30 would instantly accept that anything in place before we were born was bad, and anything put in place since 1997 was good. I actually have rather more faith in the wisdom of the present generation than the government does, and certainly any change that we or the Liberal Democrats would make would, I like to think, be more coherently thought through than the stick-a-tail on a donkey process of change that's been implemented these last few years. The arguments surrounding the Constitution are more complicated and subtle than many in the government would want it to be. There is not a group of no changers confronted by a heroic band of reformers led by Lord Faulkner. On the contrary, my party, for instance, favours a House of Lords, all of whose political members are elected directly by the people, a position that is shared by the Liberal Democrats. It's Tony Blair that's opposed it these last 8 years. If an elected House ever comes about, I will stand for election. Would the Lord Chancellor do so? Would a Labour government legislate as a Conservative or Lib Dem government would for an 80% elected House of Lords? I hardly think so. So we shouldn't get railroaded by the dated canard that we or the Liberal Democrats are against constitutional change. Not at all. What we are against is manipulation of constitutional arrangements in a single party interest. We favour a substantially elected Lords. The Prime Minister opposes it. We favour the right of every citizen to cast a vote in secret, in a ballot box. The Prime Minister opposes that. Some might think that conservative, but the risk of corruption that flows from all postal ballots should give us all pause. We favour the ancient principle of habeas corpus. The Prime Minister calls that being soft on terrorism. We favour the view that judges should decide on all control orders and that the action of the executive, even under this Prime Minister and this Home Secretary, should be subject to the courts. And it's these crucial issues, I think, that illustrate the difference between us and the government. Our view on constitutional reform starts from a very different place from the government. We look at a nation like ours, which for over 300 years has benefited from a flexible constitution. In 1688, Parliament reacted against the power, quite incredibly retaken by Tony Blair in the Civil Contingencies Act, to overthrow any act of Parliament, including the extension of the life of a Parliament, by use of the royal prerogative. Since the Glorious Revolution, we have seen in this country extraordinary social change, much of it advocated by the founders of the LSE, but we've done so without revolution, without civil war, without social conflict, and this has been accomplished largely because of the joint flexibility of our common law and our unwritten constitution. And in that time, there's not a single other major country in the world, not the USA, nor France, not Germany, not Japan, not China, not Italy, that's not been convulsed by civil war, revolution, and constitutional conflict. At the very least, against that background, I ask Mr. Blair to believe he may not be Thomas Jefferson, and there may be some merits in our flexible constitution that outweigh the back-of-the-envelope insights that we've seen develop these last few years. Against that background, those who argue for our constitution to be torn up and a new design written surely have to carry the burden of proof. But if the government can't accept that, then I would posit as four essential principles of reform. First, no reform should undermine the basic principles of English liberty that have put a stamp on our country over many centuries. That should include the right to trial by jury, the right to know the charges levelled against one, the right not to be arrested without being brought to trial. I was brought up being shocked by the fact that these rights did not exist in many other countries. And I'm shocked that this government, a Labour government, proposes their withdrawal today. Second, against the background of 300 years of peaceful evolution, our national experience should only be set aside if there's an overwhelming argument that foreign experience is superior. Thus, I am not convinced that the ECHR, from which a British government can derogate when it wishes to, is a better protection of personal rights and liberties than our very own basic law. Third, change should only be made when it can be shown to enhance personal liberty, the freedom of the subject, and improve on what we now have. Thus, I'm not convinced, as you've heard, that banning voting in person, secretly in a ballot box, as was done by this government last year for regional referendums, is superior to proven practice. The government should realise that traditional practices, such as the secret ballot, are not necessarily bad because they're old. Fourth, change must be shown to increase accountability of the executive and parliamentary control over it and not entrench further the growing power of the executive. Thus, we oppose the reduction in the powers of the Lords, which are increasingly proposed by the government. We want no guillotines, such as have wrecked the House of Commons, no government control of business, no restriction on the rights of members to amend legislation, as Labour are now suggesting. We support a substantially elected House of Lords, which would give more power to Parliament to control the executive. We propose reforms to House of Commons procedures to give backbenchers more influence. We oppose bogus regional government, rejected in the recent referendum in the North East. And we want to see a reverse in the centralisation of recent years, with power going down to local authorities, local hospitals, local schools. Choice should be made locally, not according to rules laid down in circulars and directives emanating from Whitehall. The new Labour years will be seen as the high watermark of centralised control, which, I admit, regrettably, began in the Conservative years. But we've learnt our lesson, and Michael Howard, over the last few days, and in all his policy pronouncements, is asserting a very traditional Conservative view in which the state is servant, not the master, and in which individual freedom and choice, and, to quote Adam Smith's and Edmund Burke's immortal phrases, that is, the hidden hand and the little platoons are seen as having more wisdom than the centre. Tony Blair, in his heart, never has and never could accept that view. And that's why the constitutional divide at the next election will be stark. I agree with Lord Faulkner. It may not be the issue of the general election, but is a fundamental one of importance to everybody in this country. And that's why this debate touches on our most basic liberties, and why all of us in this hall must stand on our guard against a government, any government, seeking to remove ancient liberties or to encroach on the powers of Parliament. Last week's titanic clash between Parliament and government should have brought this to the attention of every person in this country. The Prime Minister may have backed down last week, but only if we defend and enhance the authority and independence of both houses of Parliament will future governments be held to account. That's our commitment, and that's the proposition I ask you to support tonight and at the general election whenever it comes.
Thank you very much, Lord Strathclyde. We heard what I think is a broadly centralist position, followed by, I think, a broadly decentralist position. Let's see if the Liberal Democrats can come up with their familiar position roughly in between. Lord McNally.
Neither to right nor left, but forward. I always feel a little bit intimidated coming to the LSE because just over 40 years ago I actually came to University College London and I had a subsidiary, Medieval Economic History, which I took at the LSE, and it always depressed me because they all seem to be working so bloody hard here. And it's always left me with a slight intimidation about Portugal Street Polytechnic, which has been stays with me still. Between 1996 and 1997, I took part in what for me was one of the most rewarding exercises that I've ever taken part in politics. I was a member of a joint commission set up by Tony Blair and Paddy Ashdown to see if the, in advance of a general election, Labour and the Liberal Democrats could come to a joint position on constitutional reform. The joint chairmen were Robin Cook and Bob McLennan, and naturally the committee became known as the Cook-McLennan Committee. And we came together because both parties shared an analysis that our constitution, our system of government, the way it was working, was badly out of kilter and out of tune with the people it sought to serve. And I still think that Cook-McLennan was one of the best cross-party cooperative exercises that we've seen in British government. And as the Lord Chancellor said, it was not without its success. The European Convention on Human Rights was brought into British law, which we supported and still support. The assemblies for Wales, Northern Ireland and London were established, and of course the Parliament for Scotland. Systems of PR were introduced for elections to the European, Scottish, Assembly and London elections. A Freedom of Information Act was brought forward, not as radical as we would have wanted, but nevertheless a significant step forward in opening up government. An inquiry was established into voting for the parliamentary elections under Roy Jenkins, and as was said, partial reform of the House of Lords was carried through. Not everything that we wanted, not everything that we was done in the way that we wanted, but there's no doubt that in the first part of this government, if you look to a raft of constitutional change which was successfully carried through, they had their roots and origin in the pre-1997 work done jointly between the Labour Party and the Liberal Democrats. And then they got into office, and then they got into their ministerial cars, and then they got surrounded by that whole comfort zone of power, and the rot set in. Lords' reform stalled. Constitutional and legal reform was botched. A civil service belay was delayed and mothballed. Devolution to the English regions was incredibly mishandled. I can just imagine Tony Blair sitting in Downing Street and saying, it's okay, I've handed over constitutional reform, it's in safe hands, it's going to be handled by John Prescott and Charlie Faulkner. Oh, Prime Minister. Yes, Prime Minister. I mean, the Laurel and Hardy of British politics.
That'd be quite flattering.
So, we have not had the same momentum, and part, I would argue, of why we've not had the same momentum is that we've not had the input into constitutional reform that was supplied by the Liberal Democrats during that earlier period. And I tend to agree with Tom Strathclyde. Part of the problem has been that a lot of the later ideas at constitutional reform have looked like they've been written on the back of an envelope, and even worse, looked like they've been concocted not in the broad national long-term interest, but with a very short-term party advantage calculation. And that can never be good for constitutional reform. And at the same time, we've had a whole session, a series of inquiries, which have lifted the lid on Whitehall. Hutton and Butler both showed the extraordinary system of decision-making in Downing Street, sitting on that Downing Street sofa without minutes being taken, without nobody knowing exactly who's present, a recipe for wrong decisions and disasters. And the Phyllis report into the government information service that again showed dangerous levels of intimidation and abuse corrupted our government information service, and which, to be fair, the government has now brought in corrective message. So what I'm saying is that the government still has time to repent. If they're going into this election committed to constitutional reform, they can certainly have our support once again. But I do think we want to see this time a real commitment to reform of voting for the House of Commons. It is a fact that something less than 40% of the electorate can now elect 60% of the House of Commons. If we have a turnout, as is heading this way, of 50% of the electorate voting, that means that one in five of the electorate could supply a landslide victory in the House of Commons. Now, I would submit to you that when your electoral system becomes so distorted, there is a real danger of providing the elected dictatorship which Lord Hailsham warned against a couple of decades ago. And that's why, unless there is a substantial reform of the composition of the House of Commons, any reform of the House of Lords has to be treated very carefully. It is an amazing kind of paradox of history that here we have the Conservative Party in favour of a directly elected House of Lords being blocked by a Labour Party who want a house of patronage. 100 years of Labour history thrown out of the window. It is quite mind-boggling. And I do say, I've said this to him in the House, and I will say it again, if the Labour Party think that they can go into this election with a couple of lines in their manifesto hinting at some trimming of the Lord's powers, and they come back into power trying to cut the power of the House of Lords, they will have a very, very strong fight from our benches on this. Because, again, one of the strange paradoxes of our history that we've seen from last week's events is that this overcrowded, ancient, funny old institution called the House of Lords is now the primary barrier to the exercise of an abuse of executive power in this country. And until we have proper and fundamental reform of the Commons so that it can do its proper job of holding the executive to the account, I believe that the House of Lords should hold on to its powers, because they're the only powers we've got. I will couple that, because I see the chairman getting excited, with the reform of a Civil Service Act. The government have promised it. Let's see if they deliver. They've had 8 years, and they've kept it in mothballs. But again, one of the great gifts of the 19th and 20th century to the 21st is the integrity, the neutrality, the appointment on merit of our civil service. And it is essential that that is underpinned by a Civil Service Act that gives it that protection. The Hansard Society showed that at the present moment, 34% of people think our system of government works well, 63% needs improving. 25 years ago, it was 48%, 49%, about 50-50 division. So we need to put constitutional reform at the centre of this election to reconnect the electorate with the political process, to revitalise and re-energise our institutions, but most importantly, to make sure that the checks and balances are in place to bring to account an overmighty executive and safeguard our civil liberties and human rights.
Thank you very much indeed, Tom. One of the problems I think we see with the House of Lords ruling is that they're all too nice to each other. Let's see if we can get some less politesse into the rest of the debate. I'm going to kick off by asking Lord Faulkner just one question. You boasted the signature of Her Majesty's Government to the European Convention on Human Rights. Why was almost the first thing you did to derogate from it?
Because it wasn't the first thing we did. We did it after 9/11, and it's been the derogation itself was upheld by the courts. The particular measures taken after the derogation were not, and we accepted that. And that represents a very, very fundamental change. Tom's points about basic freedoms were very odd in the light of his rejection of the Convention on Human Rights. The basic freedoms referred to there are a freedom not to be put in prison without proper process, a freedom against torture, a freedom to have one's life preserved, all of the things I would have thought Tom was keen to preserve. I'm surprised that he doesn't want those things enshrined in law and in a way that can be enforced. One of the remarkable things about what happened post the 16th of December, when the law struck the thing down, was that the government accepted that that meant the courts were in effect deciding where the line was to be drawn, and that is a very, very significant change. You described my position as being a centralist position. Far from it, it was not. The government, in so many respects, has divested itself of power, taken away from central government the power to do things, like interest rates, like defining where the line is drawn, like devolution, and there wasn't a mention of it from either Tom or Tom. Indeed, there wasn't a mention at all from Tom or Tom of any of our constitutional changes. They talked generally about things, but didn't for one moment specify whether what we'd done was right or wrong, or specify what they would do, with one exception, and that was Lord Strathclyde referred to what he described as the Tory party supporting a elected element in the House of Lords. I should tell you that Tom Strathclyde is like a man parachuted behind enemy lines in the House of Lords. His own party in the House of Lords, that is the Conservative Party, voted 3-1 against any elected element in the House of Lords. So for him to sit there with a straight face and say the Tory party are in favour of an elected element is the most extraordinary humbug on his part. The other thing I should say about him, he was talking about habeas corpus, and his party supported, in my view rightly, the control orders in the Prevention of Terrorism Act. Yes, they wanted changes, but they supported them. So the further humbug that he's putting about, that they did not support, as he would put it, the Prevention of Terrorism Act, is wrong. There was no connection, I am afraid, between what Tom was saying and what the Tory party either stands for or does.
Tom.
Well, thank you very much for that, Charlie. You want to be a bit more aggressive. Of course, on the House of Lords, what was the great promise in the mid-1990s from Tony Blair? The House of Lords is an affront to democracy. Well, if it was an affront to democracy then, what on earth is it now? It's not surprising. Some of us have moved forward on this, not everybody. In fact, what is interesting about the debate is the perceived differences that exist, not between the parties, but very often within the parties. And that's what's got to be resolved, and the best way of doing that is not by go-it-alone policies that we've seen by this government, but to try to create a consensus. And that is the best way of creating constitutional change. Now, as for last week, let's just remember what the original bill that the government wanted. It was giving a right to the Home Secretary to lock people up in their sitting rooms rather than in prison, on the barest suspicion. That's what happened. It was only due to the parliamentary process that things were changed sufficiently enough for the Conservative Party to accept with.
Which you then accepted, and you were railing against the suspension of habeas corpus. So you accepted that.
You capitulated totally.
You agreed with it, supported it.
Yeah, but as soon as a judge is involved, it ceases, and there is a judicial process, then there is a changed situation.
I see.
The difference between that and having the Home Secretary, a politician deciding who should have their liberties removed, that strikes me as being a very different question altogether.
We could keep this going. I'd ask, before we go to the poll, one question on proportional representation. It's always been the case that the third parties are in favour of it until they become second parties. Your leader says you're going to be the second if the first, not the first party this time, so maybe you'll change your policy on that. But it's interesting, isn't it, that now across Europe, countries that have proportional representation, as a result of which you tend to have a stage army of politicians in power almost continuously, like Norway, Israel, Denmark, Italy, are turning against proportional representation in favour of the British system. Will you change?
No, I don't. I do think that what is a real danger in the British system as it works out. I think even the Conservative Party, it suddenly might dawn on at a system where if they're 3% ahead in the polls, they will still only get parity with the Labour Party, and they need to be something like 6% before they even get a working majority. When your system is so distorted, it is in need of repair. The Jenkins Committee advised an alternative vote system. I do not think that our system will long sustain the kind of distortions which are being produced in the House of Commons, particularly if they're coupled with an attack by that majority in the House of Commons on any attempts to restrain them. Charlie gave a marvellous, didn't Parliament work well? That wasn't what they were saying about 2:30 on Friday morning about the House of Lords. I was there, and I actually bumped into the Home Secretary in the lobby. Not the most pleasant of experiences at 2 o'clock in the morning, I can tell you. But I just really am now. But by the way, just a correction. It's great to see Lord Faulkner in prosecuting counsel mode. You can see how he earned his money. But in fact, what I pointed out, I didn't totally ignore what the government did in its first 3 or 4 years. I claimed credit for what the government did in the first 3 or 4 years. But
can I tell you a secret about Tom McNally? He was, for a period of time, a Labour Member of Parliament. Can I tell you something else about him? When he was a Labour Member of Parliament, he never, with tears in his eyes, talked about the House of Lords in the way that he does now, and he certainly wasn't in favour of PR. What happened?
The system. Well, for one thing, I worked for a Prime Minister, Jim Callaghan, who would have not spent 48 hours cowering in a Downing Street bunker and coming out only to talk to Sky Television. Jim had enough respect for the House of Commons to come to the House of Commons and argue his case, which our Prime Minister should. And it's the body language of this Prime Minister, his arrogance, his high-handed attitude towards Parliament. He comes as little as he possibly can, and when he comes, he shows impatience with the way it behaves. And I think that the one good thing about last week, which he may have learned the hard way, is that Parliament will do its duty and will protect civil liberties. And just again for the record, the Liberal Democrats did vote against those orders because I do not think you deliver that. One of the things the Prime Minister, an absurd thing the Prime Minister said, that the greatest civil right is a protection from terrorism. There is no absolute protection from terrorism. And if you're going to go chipping away at civil liberties for every excuse that it's a protection of terrorism, you'll find yourself in a society that we're supposed to be defending ourselves from the terrorists. We lose out by this approach. And the 2001 Act was rammed through Parliament with emergency, with the same accusations from Labour. If you don't give us this power, you're soft on terrorism. And they were at it again this week. And it's a dangerous and slippery slope.
Okay.
Contributions
on the floor. Just before, Tom didn't mention again that the Liberal Democrats did in fact support control orders. They wanted changes in the burden of proof, but they supported the principle.
Right. Let's go to the ground. Keep them very short, please, and let's make it really punchy. Yes, first there. Yes, go.
May I support Lord McNally's points about the electoral system by offering a better calculation about the way in which the electoral system deviates from the fundamental principles of democracy by saying that this Labour government, elected with 160 seats majority, was elected by 42% of the voters on a 59% participation. Anyone who cared to multiply these two numbers will come to the conclusion that this government support is less than 25% of the registered voters. Now, if you excuse me, Mr. Chairman, can I put a question, a short question, to Lord Falkner?
You can put it, but he's not going to answer it right now. Just cause, be quick, because everyone wants to have a word.
Now, the New Labour Manifesto for 2001 says that the upper house will be reformed in a way that it becomes more representative and more democratic. Now, during the voting in the House of Commons, the gossip has it that the Prime Minister has mobilized the whips and he secured that no option has received a majority. And then he came as a new Archimedes with Eureka and imposed his own preferred option, which was 0% representation in the House, elected members in the House of Lords. And they tell us that this is more representative and more democratic. Perhaps you may comment on that.
Thank you very much. Yes, there's a quick.
Lord Strathclyde referred to us as subjects, which I believe we are at the moment. But shouldn't we actually be citizens in our own country? Shouldn't we get rid of monarchy?
Yes, you there.
Thank you. Lord Strathclyde, it appeared to me that you contradicted yourself in part of your speech. On the one hand, you alluded to a Burkean philosophy that our institutions are great because they have lasted through time, and that therefore Lord Falkner shouldn't make rushed reforms. And on the other hand, you made the promise that the Conservatives would make the House of Lords an elected chamber. And if anything, that seems to be a rushed policy on the Conservative part, especially when it means that we'd have two exactly the same Houses of Parliament doing exactly the same job.
Thank you very much. There's a lady there.
Why can't we have a written constitution so everybody will know very clearly where they stand, where the rights are? Thank you.
Yeah, here. One down here.
Neutral. Simon. Lord McNally mentioned freedom of information. I'd like to ask Lord Falkner why he thinks that this government does not feel it fit to release the Attorney General's legal opinion for going to war.
We have to wait on tentacles for a few minutes more. Anyone up there? There's a gentleman there, yes.
Each of the three wards have talked on how the Constitution worked for 300 years, but not one of them has actually approached where the Constitution actually failed in that last 300 years, which was mentioned to keep Ireland either fully as a part of Great Britain or not a part of Great Britain.
Ireland. That's a very extremely good point. Yes, there's a man here. One of your short questions, keep them coming.
We've heard a lot about proposed electoral reform for the House of Lords if the House of Lords were to be largely elected. However, it's a truth that the executive in this country dominates the legislature via its inbuilt Commons majority. The fact that the Conservative Party now supports a largely elected House of Lords is very new and is a development that's only occurred since the Conservatives went into opposition. So I would put it perhaps to the members of the panel that maybe we should be realistic and we should think of a system of election or composition for the House of Lords that would be acceptable to the all-powerful executive. So I'd be interested for their views on any notion that the House of Lords could perhaps be indirectly elected. The Senates of France and Ireland are, for example, indirectly elected by local government. That means that they don't actually have the well, just like the House of Lords, they don't have the legitimacy to take on the elected House of the elected lower chambers, in a way similar to the House of Lords. But they are nevertheless more legitimate than an unelected, totally unelected chamber as at present.
Thank you. Take one more this round. Yes, you.
Lord Strathclyde, you mentioned that rather than the Human Rights Act, which could be derogated from, that our rights should be protected by basic law. Did you mean the common law? And if so, do you really think it's powerful enough to enforce those rights against the executive?
Very quickly, let's come to the panel again. Tom, do you want to?
I mean, a magnificent panoply of questions to deal with. PR, I'm just very, very quickly, one of the joys of an election is an opportunity to get rid of a government rather than vote for one. That's certainly what happened in 1997, I'm sorry to say. Under PR, that's much more difficult. It puts power in the hands of small parties and can entrench the fossilization of the body politic rather than getting the tremendous change that we got in 1997, whether you agree with that change or not. It was a real change. And finally, one of the biggest drawbacks I have with PR, and I'm a semi-victim of PR because I live in Scotland, where there is a form of PR for the Scottish Parliament, is it's fiendishly complicated to understand who your representatives are, how they get there. If you wanted to get rid of them, you can't. Likewise for the European Parliament, where we have stopped voting for a person, and now you can only vote for a party. So PR has its huge faults. Getting rid of the monarchy, I think the monarchy, I mean, there are plenty of countries that do not have monarchies and exist perfectly well. From that point of view, I suppose we would manage in one form or another. But the monarchy provides a continuity and a stability and a wisdom that would be impossible to replicate. And you only have to consider what an election for a president with what sort of powers. Would they have the powers of the monarch or something entirely different, and having to change entirely our body politic so as to allow that to happen, to demonstrate just what a far-reaching question that is. So I do not favour changing the monarchy. Then the question about contradiction. No, there's no contradiction here. You don't change unless you absolutely have to. The Labour Party came in and said the old House of Lords must go. There should be a two-stage process. They did one stage, and then they stopped still. And what we're saying is, well, you know, if there is a better future, if you want more legitimacy, then let's go forward and have the real change, because the current House isn't much better than the House we had in pre-1997. So that's why I say there is no contradiction. Is having elected House hasty? No, I don't think it's hasty. People have been discussing it for a long time. I mean, the 1911 Parliament Act had in its preamble that the second chamber should be elected. And if I can also answer the other question on that, the House of Lords, about indirect elections. The problem with indirect elections is that they are appointment by another name. You know, you get some local authorities, they get together and they choose somebody to go and represent them in the House of Lords. Well, what's wrong with giving it to people, the vote? Of course it's got to be on a different basis. Larger constituencies, longer periods of office, perhaps 10 or 15 years. And one of the greatest democracies, well, this is contentious, but one of the greatest democracies in America seems to manage with two democratically elected houses. Occasionally it creates a tension, a legislative tension between the two houses. Well, what's wrong with that? We have far too many laws in this country, far too many regulations. If we had actually had a system built in which reduced the numbers of laws that were passed, that would be good for everybody. And also, partly for that reason, I don't. We have a constitution. It is partly written. It is partly understood in conventions and common law. You can't go to the bookshop of the LSE and buy a thing called the British Constitution, but it exists. And it's extremely good, and I wouldn't change that. Freedom of information. Freedom of information was designed to protect this government and damage all previous governments. And Charles is the man responsible for it. And anyway, I think that that's all.
Okay.
Basically, all the questions that were.
Tom and Ali, do you want to point?
Yeah, Lords reform. I think two or three men or women of goodwill could sit down and in an afternoon probably produce a reform of the House of Lords that would make sense in terms of the concerns of the Commons, that it doesn't want its authority undermined, but would still have a revisory and an advisory role and a guardianship against executive abuse and that. But as was once put to me by a very senior cabinet minister, and I said, well, what does the Prime Minister think about this? Tony doesn't give her a bugger about all this, he said, and it shows. And unless we get this reform, as I've said before, they better not come along just thinking that they can get rid of the annoying bits of the House of Lords, because the annoying bits are what make it valuable. I'm very proud of our support both for the Convention on Human Rights. I think that obviously there will be growing pains as we get used to exactly what rights it does give, and like freedom of information, I would like the government to treat it more what we said, to end the culture of secrecy in Whitehall unless there's a damage limitation exercise. But I think in the long run, Freedom of Information Act will change and empower the individual. Ireland, well, we can only read our history and weep that Gladstone didn't succeed in his mission to pacify Ireland. It did split the Liberal Party, and we paid in blood ever since. Perhaps a realization by the Irish people that if they don't find a constitutional settlement, they'll end up with a kind of fascism in Ireland as they vote for extremes, maybe a lesson they learned the hard way. The monarchy, well, I don't think, because they're both combing, I don't think there's any Liberal Democrat policy to abolish the monarchy, otherwise they'd have found it and exposed it. And anyway, what I think is, if we did abolish the monarchy, what is the deal that Gordon Brown would make with Tony?
thank you very much. Charlie Forney, can you answer the Attorney General question first?
Yes, I certainly can. I mean, in relation to the Freedom of Information Act, we've set out provisions. We have made an initial decision, but ultimately the decision on whether or not the Attorney General's legal advice will be disclosed, will be taken, assume somebody appeals the view of the government, by, first of all, the Information Commissioner, who is independent, and then the Information Tribunal. The reason why we believe it should not be disclosed is that you want to encourage the government to take legal advice before it does anything. Any organisation that takes legal advice would not normally expect that advice to be disclosed. The reason why you wouldn't expect that advice to be disclosed was because before you had taken the advice, if you thought the world or the other side, if it's litigation, was going to see it, you'd be worried if it damaged your position in some way or not. If that was your anxiety, you wouldn't take advice, and that is a very, very bad thing indeed. That is why there is a convention against the law officer's advice being disclosed in government. That is why you've got something called legal professional privilege, which prevents advice being disclosed. But the critical element of the Freedom of Information Act is that it's not ultimately the government who decides, it's these independent bodies that decides.
Will you be happy if it's disclosed?
We'll accept whatever view the independent body decides. And ultimately, the truth of our commitment to freedom of information is that ultimately we have given it over to independent bodies to do it. The Yes Minister series of comedy programmes has this fantastic thing about freedom of information, which is you have governments absolutely gung-ho to introduce freedom of information until they get into power, at which point Sir Humphrey within 35 seconds has persuaded them that it's not a good idea, but if you do want to introduce it, then you've got to be sure that you can broadly say no to everything. Well, we didn't do that. We introduced a freedom of information which divested us of the power to say no. And if you watch the television, read the newspapers, look at the radio, since January there is persistent information that is transforming the relationship between the citizen and the state. And the state doesn't just mean central government, it means, for example, the people who run your hospitals. Now people are publishing the success or failure rates of individual surgeons. Now people are publishing the amount that is spent on books in particular schools. Now people are publishing how much
each individual speed camera gets. Now they're publishing how often the speed camera's got film on it. They're empowering the citizen in a way that has never been done before. Tom and Tom are sort of political gadflies who basically criticise what we do but really don't propose an alternative. We did freedom of information. It will make a real difference, and it is something that is damaging and difficult for governments to do, but it makes the country better government.
But you, so do, your level, you do your level best not to publish the Attorney General's information.
Because we think it is wrong. And remember, every single government since time begun has accepted the proposition that the legal advice of the law officers should not be published, because when you want to take advice on something, you want a completely free conversation with your legal advisor in which you explore strengths and weaknesses. And that is a perfectly legitimate way to buy. If you're, when you were the editor of the Times and you wanted to discuss legal advice about a libel action, or you wanted to discuss legal advice about a particular thing that you were doing, the idea that you couldn't discuss it freely with your legal advisor would be complete nonsense.
I wasn't going to war.
It would strike you as completely absurd that you couldn't have that discussion. And it seems to me a government is the same, in the same position. But, as I say, that is not a view that you need to accept or not in the end, because ultimately the Commissioner and the Tribunal will decide in relation to it.
Okay. Can we go back to the
sure.
hall? Okay. I've got a feeling how many people there's. Lady at the back there. It's coming.
What's the view of our guest speakers on the adoption of the Constitutional Treaty for the European Union?
Uh-huh. It'll keep us going the rest of the night. Right, okay. There's one down here. Yes.
What do you propose for if you have an elected second chamber? How do you see the Lords as they come forward as the champion of minorities and as a scrutiny chamber? How do you see them after a reform chamber?
Thank you. I'm going up to into the top. The one who's reaching for it now. Okay.
Hi. Just two things. For the Conservative peer, actually I think the Prime Minister's got more power than the American President, for example, because he can declare war using a royal prerogative, whereas the President has to ask legislative approval. And secondly, regarding the Freedom of Information Act, I think there's so many exceptions, and a minister of the day can always veto it. And also regarding your client legal kind of confidentiality, it sounds more like a circular argument, that because there's confidentiality, then you ask for advice. So it sounds to me it's more like circular argument. Doesn't really explain why you shouldn't disclose the argument.
Thank you. I have a document on my desk which is a passionate argument against the royal prerogative ever being used as a totally undemocratic weapon of executive government by Jack Straw. the lady there, yes, Brian.
Lord Strathclyde didn't answer the question before about why he thought our law was better before the Human Rights Act. And I want him to answer that.
Good point. Thank you. And with the cap, yes.
Yes. Charlie Faulkner touched on the fact that devolution had strengthened the union. I'm not sure what they think in Wales and Scotland, but as an Englishman and a strong unionist, now devolution's come in, I've actually sort of gone towards a more English, having a parliament just for English people, because we have Scottish MPs who are voting on laws which just affect the English and Welsh. And you have a ridiculous situation where you have a Secretary of State for Health who has his constituency, Scotland, is presiding over a health system which just affects the English. So this can't be real representative democracy.
The English Assembly question. Right, we'll come to that. Yes, you've been waving your hand.
Just to come back. The Times has the luxury of existing for the good of the people that own it. The government, unfortunately, doesn't have that luxury. It exists at the sufferance of the British people. And for the government to say that they are not going to release the legal opinion on which they purportedly went to war on behalf of this country, of the British people, seems to me completely wrong-headed. And with respect, I think that Lord Faulkner avoided the question.
Well, he'll doubtless welcome it when he's overruled by the Ombudsman. So it's all right. Yes, you.
The process.
Yes.
Lord Strathclyde, you may think this is somewhat facetious, but you mentioned in defence of the royal family the wisdom that was brought with them. And I was wondering which particular male in line to the throne, Prince Harry, Prince Charles, or Prince William, was the burning academic you referred to.
Okay. Chap in the front there, and get the microphone to him. Nope. Just shout.
Is that better?
Yeah.
The Human Rights Act may be an effective shield against the worst encroachments by even bodies which aren't public authorities. So, for example, private limited companies, public limited companies that effectively commit human rights abuses can't do so and get past the courts, because the courts themselves are a public authority. However, does it work as a sword? Probably not, because as those sort of bodies aren't public authorities, how can anybody bring a Human Rights Act claim against, say, a public limited company, which is, in effect, committing human rights abuses? And the second aspect of my question is that are these rights illusory if they're rights without a real remedy, in the sense that if we say that you have a right to bring a claim about human rights abuses, and yet where's the legal aid? And is the legal aid subject to a statutory charge, so that if anybody actually wins compensation, it's eaten alive by legal charges? Which are one or two jurisdictions, even in the British Isles, where there is no statutory charge, so it's a real issue. And I was in the House of Lords when you mentioned about the exceptional cases where you might be able to get legal aid for defamation. Mm. And I wondered if you could expand on that at all.
Very briefly.
Thanks.
We'll come on to that. I'll take two more, then we'll come down here. Should I just get some feeling for where I haven't been? I'll take that one there and the lady there, okay?
Yes, can I say that I think there's been a lot of political posturing today and over the last few months because of the election. I frankly find the idea that the Conservative Party, given its history, is actually in favour of an elected House of Lords to be risible. But I'd also like to suggest there's also been some political posturing by the government in regards to the recent legislation in regard to terrorism. And the government was probably had an eye to the polls in regard to the general public's view about they wanted to go hard on terrorism.
Thank you very much. The lady there with the book. She's not going to read out.
Lord Faulkner, is this government justified in using the Parliament Act to get through bills the Lords have overturned?
Okay, thank you very much, everybody. Now I'm going to ask the three panellists to sum up. Lord McNally first.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember all the questions you asked.
The gentleman up there about political posturing, it was the lady who said that she never voted because it only encouraged them. I mean, politicians do start posturing about this time in the parliamentary cycle. It's part of the DNA of us all. But on you know, Lords of Reform, as Tom Strathclyde kindly pointed out, it was the 1911 Liberal government that brought forward the first of Lords Reform with the promise of a democratic house. And you know, 100 years doesn't seem rushing at the thing. The Parliament Act, yes, the government is entitled, and I do believe that the House of Lords, as we did last Friday, should use every power that we were given by the Democratic House, which is what we were doing last Friday. But I do believe that in the end, the Democratic House, the House of Commons, is the body that has the last say in these things. And the Parliament Act was there to make sure that is so. We support a written constitution. We would like to take away the royal prerogative. It can be dangerously used. I think the English dimension would the gentleman, the so-called West Lothian question, that would have been put into better perspective if the government had more imaginatively and more generously devolved to the English regions, but it didn't. The gentleman that was asking for free legal advice, you better get the best rather than me, who knows nothing about the law. You can get some good free advice from the Lord Chancellor. As to the gentleman asking the question about the heirs to the throne, over a long history, I think having too clever a king is probably as dangerous as having too stupid a one. So somewhere in the middle is not too bad.
You apply that to the Prime Minister as well.
Is this sort of second chamber and political posturing ridiculous that the or risible that the elected that the Conservative Party should champion an elected House of Lords? I guess to the heart of it, what do you want this thing to do, the second chamber? What's the purpose of Parliament? It's to hold the executive to account. It can only do that if it's strong. Now, I'm one who favours a stronger second chamber, more independent of the executive, possibly more independent of party if we can achieve that. And in the 21st century, I think the only place you get parliamentary authority from is from the people. And therefore there is nothing strange in a Conservative Party now being seen to champion democracy for the second chamber. Of course that's got to be part of a total reform of Parliament, which is why also, interestingly enough, it's the Conservative Party that is saying there should be a smaller House of Commons, down to perhaps 450 or 500, down from 650. There should be fewer ministers, fewer special advisers. We have created a monstrous machine of government, and I don't just blame the Labour Party for this. This has been created over decades, and it's now time to take a long, hard think about the nature of the parliamentary institutions that we have, and where they derive their power from. And that's why, just jumping to the Parliament Act question, I think the Parliament Act is an important safeguard for the parliamentary process. Because if we currently have an undemocratic House, it allows a democratic House to get its way. And it is used very rarely. The most recent occasion it was used was perhaps the worst possible example, because it was used on an issue that the government itself did not support, on a free vote issue of conscience that was never in a manifesto. That is on the Hunting Bill, or the Hunting Act, whatever your view is about hunting. That is a sledgehammer to crack a nut. The Parliament Act is only used when Parliament has failed, and therefore it's incumbent on everybody within Parliament to try and make sure that you reach an agreement, you reach a compromise. And that, I think, is the agreement that's been built up over the last 100 years. You use the Parliament Act sparingly. There is always the incentive to negotiate and come to an agreement. And on the whole, over the last few decades, that is what has happened. Now, freedom of information, presidential powers. Yes, it is true that the Prime Minister's powers are far stronger than that of an American president. But that's why a strong parliament is important. In the 1940s, Winston Churchill came to the House of Commons again and again and again to derive the authority from which he could conduct the campaign. And he chose at that time to take the House of Commons into his confidence. That is something that the current administration has never done on going to war with Iraq. And on this question of the Attorney General's advice, I understand exactly what the Lord Chancellor is saying. Charlie.
Feel free.
It's a good job your name's not Jerry, I tell you that.
Or Tom.
Or another Tom.
Tom Tom's
I can understand exactly what he's saying about the privileged information of this advice. But the controversy has continued for so long, I think it is inevitable that it will come out. I'm not convinced it will help us very much. What the key point is How was that advice given? What pressures were brought to bear on the Attorney General? What information did he have at his disposal? Did he believe, as we did, as I did, that there genuinely was a threat of weapons of mass destruction, that we were 45 minutes away from missiles raining down on London, all of which turned out to be untrue. And it is the validity of the reasons for that advice that I think we ought to test. Now, there were a number of questions about the Human Rights Act and what I said about basic law. The Human Rights Act does not protect human rights. Let me give you two examples. Recently, the papers, the tabloids, have been full of these problems of gypsies. Now, whatever sympathy we may all have for the problem of gypsies, it cannot be right, I believe, I contend, that anybody can go and dig up a field, pitch up semi-permanent homes, and then invoke the Human Rights Act. What about the human rights of all the people in the neighbourhood who are affected by that, and the planning laws that were created to defend those communities in the first place? And yet it is the Human Rights Act that is brought in to defend them. Secondly, the Prevention of Terrorism Act was brought about by a ruling of the judges on the Human Rights Act because they said that the Belmarsh prisoners was discriminatory because they were foreigners. Well, I just think that's an absurd use of our law. Far better to have retained a position where the Belmarsh prisoners were kept in Belmarsh and not have introduced these controlled orders, which will now affect every man, woman and child in the United Kingdom. The Human Rights Act has created the danger of a real politicisation of the judiciary, the historic independence of the British judiciary, and given them the power, potentially, to strike down legislation. That is an awesome power. And that's why I support the view that the ECHR now needs to be reviewed for the 20th century, not abolished. It needs to be reviewed and thought through on exactly how it impinges. I can see you're getting itchy because you want to move on. Quickly on English nationalism. I think this is so right. And something I am fearful for the United Kingdom. I am a unionist. I believe that culturally, geographically, in every way possible, the United Kingdom, the constituent parts of the United Kingdom are stronger working together than apart. But there is a force of English nationalism growing, a desire to see an English parliament, that too much English resources go to the peripheral parts of the United Kingdom, the questions posed by the so-called West Lothian question. And that's why I think that English votes for English laws. Parliamentarians voted for and elected in English constituencies should have a say over English laws, not Scots and not Welsh. That would be fair, that would be sustainable, and would have none of the effects that we have at the moment. I follow with Tom McNally about the wisdom of the monarchy. This is not a question about academic intelligence. It is about creating that stability and the collective wisdom of the ages that I think has served the interests of this country extremely well.
Thank you very much. Lord Chancellor.
I think that the debate that we've had, which has been incredibly high quality and very, very interesting, reveals that there is a sense of uneasiness about the Constitution. I think the critical question when addressing the Constitution is, does it adequately reflect and connect with the aspirations of the people? We talked about PR. Simon referred to the fact that in certain countries where PR is popular, you end up with a revolving group of the same people constantly being in power. A situation where the politician gets totally disconnected from the people that they serve. Now, I don't know how it's happened, but in our country, you find that first-past-the-post elections appear to reflect very much what the views of the public are. I think during the 80s, the Labour government, the Labour Party, was very, very unpopular and effectively unelectable. The consequence was that the Conservatives won very significant victories time after time in the 80s. That reflected, I think, the will of the people. In 1997, I don't know what you think, but there was a very, very strong view that the Conservative government should be thrown out and the Labour government should be given a very big chance. And that's what's happened. So our system, however it does it, works in reflecting the will of the people. I am strongly against introducing any new system because I don't think it would be as good as reflecting the people, at reflecting the views of the people. In relation to that system continuing to work, it absolutely depends upon the Commons having primacy. The role of the Lords must be not to compete with the Commons, but to scrutinise legislation, to say to the Commons, think again. The need to have a delaying power in order to make that effective is very, very important. But if we believe that our electoral system does produce the results that people broadly want in this country, and I believe that it does, then we've got to preserve A, the primacy of the Commons, but B, an effective revising chamber, and that means preserving its power to delay, but also making sure that it's got the confidence of the people when it scrutinises and delays. I think broadly the Lords have been good at choosing issues. I think as time goes on, its composition needs to change, because if its composition doesn't change, it won't continue to have the confidence of the people. Tom said rather smugly that three men of goodwill would be able to work out a system quite quickly for what that composition should be. You'll all know that the first Parliament Act has in its preamble a reference to the fact there's going to be another Parliament Act coming soon which will revise the House of Lords. Those three men of goodwill have been impossible to find over the last 100 years, and there's constant disagreement. But I think it's quite urgent that we reach agreement in relation to it, because my feeling, not just about this room but generally, is the public do want an effective revising second chamber, not one to take on the first chamber, but one that is effective enough to ensure that there is proper scrutiny. On the points about the convention, my heart sank when I heard what Tom was saying. It seems to me to be utterly vital, and I think the public strongly feel this, that you can't trust the politicians to decide everything. There are certain rights that we look to the courts to protect. And what Tom was doing, and it was awful, was identifying those rights he likes from the convention and those rights he doesn't. He referred to a review of the convention. That sounds to me like the Conservative Party saying, the convention's going if we get into power, and just leave it to us lot to determine whether or not your basic rights are safe. We've determined it for the last 20 or 30 years before 1997, and we can determine it again. Well, don't listen. Ultimately, I think what we need is the courts to protect us in a number of ways. Sometimes they'll get it wrong, but that's the nature of accepting the rule of law. Finally, in relation to devolution, devolution is about connection. I think people in Scotland and Wales had lost faith in the Westminster government to reflect their views adequately. Yes, people complain about the new bodies in Wales and Scotland, but if you said to them, we'll take those assemblies and parliaments away, they would be horrified, and they would very much think that weakened the union. A question was asked earlier on about have we been successful in relation to Ireland. We most certainly have not over the last 100 years. We're trying to remedy it now, but it takes time. But it's an indication, I think, of how important the Constitution is. We've spent the last 7 or 8 years trying to make it better. We've actually been doing things. I think we're making progress, but I think there's a lot more to do. Thank you very much indeed.
Okay. Thank you very much, everybody. You've been a very civilised audience. Whether the Constitution plays quite so large a part in the coming general election, I rather doubt. It certainly should. Thank you for attending. Thank you very much to our three panellists up here. Could I say that the next two debates are next week. One on Monday is on the subject of Britain and Europe, and one on Wednesday is on the subject of education. Tickets are available outside. Thank you all for coming. Thank you for being so polite. Good night.